Good morning. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for staying for the second round. And the topic for this morning is, as was just announced, Hidur versus Kalos, Hanukkah's competing concepts of beauty. In general, Judaism seems to be of two minds regarding beauty. If you take a look on your sheet, you see source number one. This is the sort of the original don't judge a book by its cover. When Shmuel, Samuel, the prophet, comes looking for the person he's supposed to coronate to be the next king of the Jewish people, he sees a young man by the name of Eliav, who is very handsome. And the Torah says, or the Pasuk in Shmuel says, source number one, Vayhi b'vo'am v'yares Eliav v'yomer ach neged Hashem v'mishicho. It was when they came, when Shmuel came to do the selection of the next king, v'yares Eliav, he sees this young man, Eliav, and he says, neged Hashem v'mishicho, there it is, there is the anointed one. The anointed one is there opposite God. And Vayomer Hashem al Shmuel, and Hashem says to Shmuel, Al tabeit el marehu. Don't look at his appearances, v'al gova komaso, don't look at his height. Ki me'astihu, I have rejected him. Ki lo asher yireh adam. It's not as people see. Ki ha'adam yireh la'inayim, v'Hashem yireh la'levav. Because a person sees with his eyes, and God sees with the heart. So, meaning God sees that which is inside. Also popular source number two, maybe better known, Sheker Achein Behevel Hayofi Isha Yiras Hashem Hitis Halal, that charm is false, beauty is empty, a woman who is in awe of God is to be praised. So we generally are sort of trained to reject beauty and to say, well, Judaism doesn't really look at that which is beautiful. And that's certainly an idea that I was brought up to understand, but it's not entirely correct. Because take a look at source number three, please. Gemara Bava Basra. It's talking about the imahos, our matriarchs. Hakol bifnei Sarah kikof bifnei Adam. People, in general, compared to Sarah, are like a monkey compared to a person. Sarah bifnei Chava kikof bifnei Adam. And Sarah compared to Chava will be like a monkey compared to a person. So we have no beauty. We are ugly, or we're cute and we play in cages. But I think they mean ugly. They in front of Sarah, and Sarah compared to Chava is like that. And Chava bifnei Adam kikov bifnei Adam. And then the same is true from Chava to Adam, and Adam bifnei Shechina kikov bifnei Adam. And Adam compared to the Shechina, the same ratio. So the point is that there's a hierarchy of beauty. Working from where we are, to where Sarah is, to where Chava is, to where Adam is, to the Shechina. Why do we have a hierarchy like this? Why do we have a hierarchy like this? Where we say that that Sarah is so much more beautiful than Chava, and Chava is so much more beautiful than Sarah, and Adam is so much more beautiful than Chava. What is this really telling us?
You are more godlike.
More godlike? In what sense?
Mm-hmm. And all the ones you mentioned did as well, but maybe to a lesser degree as time went on.
Why should Chava have a lesser knowledge of Hashem?
Than Adam,
yeah. Why should Chava have a lesser knowledge than Adam?
For the navigation.
Chava came from Adam, yeah. I think what we're highlighting here. It's true, Chava came from Adam, but there's something more that isn't really about their internal spiritual level. It's about instead, well, I shouldn't say it isn't about their internal spiritual level, it isn't only about their internal spiritual level, there's something else going on here, which is, Adam is made by Hashem entirely, Chava is made, formed, from the material that is Adam. And so therefore, there's a difference in terms of their beauty, as we're putting it here. Yeah.
The people in Sarah, I mean, they're all formed from the same.
Right. And that's why I say it isn't only about being formed by God, it's also about the spiritual level. That has to figure into this too. But I think that there are really two ways in which we're gauging here. One is how great this person is, what that person's spiritual level is, and the other is also the connection to Hashem. My point isn't really to discuss and debate Adam versus Chava versus Sarah versus us, but only to show how they choose to describe the difference in the levels. I could have just as easily said, there's Sarah, and then there's Chava, and then there's Adam, and then there's Hashem, right? But instead, we gave it a characteristic, and the characteristic that we gave it is beauty, right? We said, this one is like a monkey before that one, and this one is like a monkey before that one. They're not talking about it in terms of being primitive. That's not the point is not being primitive. I realize as I'm saying this that I didn't bring you Rashi on this. They're talking about it in terms of beauty.
Standing alone, you
could, standing alone, you could have taken that in another way. I agree.
Maybe since the last comparison is the Shekhinah,
right,
which doesn't sound like it's a physical, no physical beauty aspect.
Right. Although, I mean, you could definitely argue that, and in fact, the Greeks would, as we'll see. But yes, the general trend with this source and with other sources is to view the Imahos as being beautiful. So much so that there's kind of a shock when the Gemara says about Esther that she was Yirach Rokes and she was of olive tinged skin, and then the Gemara has to deal with the fallout from that. I don't think that we have a clear vision of the importance of beauty within Judaism. And I think that one way to get a clearer understanding of what beauty is about to the Jew is to look actually at Hanukkah and the difference between the Jewish and the Greek approaches to beauty. Now, when I was taught in school about Hanukkah and about Hellenism and Greek culture, they emphasized for us that the Greeks were all about the beauty of the body. That was something that they taught us. That's all you heard also? The Olympics, right? The Olympics were classic because you always knew, you could tell that to a fourth grade boy, right? Excuse me, in Canada, a grade four boy. And tell him about them competing and they're not wearing clothes. You knew that was an image that was going to stay in his mind forever. And whether he'd come out of that Greek or Jewish is a good question, but you knew that it was an image that he's going to remember that long after anything else you explained to him about Hanukkah. But the problem is that it's not quite accurate. That's not an accurate representation of the Greek concept of beauty, and I don't necessarily think that you need a shiur on the Greek concept of beauty, except that it really informs us about the Jewish concept and where the differences are between the two matter a great deal. First of all, it's important to note, the Greeks did romanticize the body, that's true. You can't get out of the sculptures and the Olympics and so on. But they also spoke about virtue as beautiful. They spoke about music as beautiful. They spoke about mathematical proportions, and not of people, but mathematical proportions in the universe as beautiful. That's number one. Number two, in our Hanukkah celebration, we talk about physical beauty all the time. Where does physical beauty come into the Hanukkah celebration? You can cheat and look on the sheet. Take a look at source number four as one example. Describes the menorah made by the Maccabees, by the Hashmonaim, after they defeated the Greeks. Shvudim shel barzel hayu. Their menorah was made out of iron rods. V'chipum beba'atz. And then the Hashmonaim coated them with tin. It was something that they could, that made it nicer, apparently. Ha'eshiru, they became wealthier. Asom shel kesef, they made it out of silver. Chazu v'ha'eshirum v'ha'eshiru, then they became wealthier. Asom shel zav, they finally made the menorah out of gold. Now, had they gone from tin to gold, or from iron to gold, I would have said the reason why you want to upgrade is because the original menorah was made of gold. Right, that's what you had in the Mishkan. The tabernacle the Jews had in the wilderness was made of gold, so therefore you want gold. But if my only goal is to try to mirror what existed in the Mishkan, what's with all the intermediate steps? Why bother with tin? Right, save up for gold, and when you have gold, then you do it and replace the one that you have. Why is it that they go through these intermediate stages? Why do you upgrade? It's what they could afford.
And it's more beautiful than the previous.
I'm trying to have a beautiful menorah. The only material you should not use for a menorah is probably wood, on a guess. But really, there's nothing wrong with an iron menorah. and I'm not telling people not to use the ones that their kids made in school with wood. The bottle caps are safe. But there's nothing wrong with an iron menorah, but the idea is I get a silver menorah that looks nicer. It's not just Hanukkah. We do that in general. We say that the mitzvah items that we use are supposed to be beautiful. The Gemara says you're supposed to have a nice sukkah, you're supposed to have a nice lulav, you're supposed to have a nice esrog. This is a part of what we call zeh keli ve'anvehu. This is my God, I will glorify him. And it's a term that we call hidur mitzvah. Beautifying a mitzvah. This is an ideal of ours. Far from saying the Greeks are wrong with their emphasis on beauty, we absolutely believe in beautifying mitzvahs. Take a look at source number 5 from Maseches Sofrim. You may be familiar with the canonization of the Gemara, where the sages took a verbal tradition, a tradition that had existed to explain the written Torah for centuries and centuries, and they said, we need to write this down. This was a period of time when the Romans were killing people for teaching Torah. There's a lot more that goes into this. It's a shir in its own right. But they said, you know what, we need to write this down. And they wrote it down first in an outline form called the Mishnah, canonized in the 3rd century. And then the expanded version with a lot more discussion is the Gemara, and that's written down in the middle of the 6th century. That's Mishnah and Gemara, that together they form Talmud. However, simultaneously, we have what are called miniature volumes, Masechtos Ketanos. And those don't make it into Talmud proper. They are sort of attached to it, and they're from roughly the same era, and they carry great authority. And one of those is called Maseches Sofrim. As it sounds, Sofrim means... Sorry? Writing, scribes. And a lot of it is about Safrut, the art of writing Sefer Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzah. But take a look at what this has to say about the menorah that we use on Hanukkah. Source number 5. V'asur lahadlik b'ner yashan. One may not light an old lamp. V'im ein lo ela yashan. And if all he has is an old lamp, malabno b'ur yafe, yafe umutter. Then you know what you do? You whiten it well in fire, and now it'll be permitted. This is talking about something made of clay, obviously. I'm not doing this with my metal menorah. If you try that, go back to the wood one. But the idea is that it shouldn't be something that is old. An old clay menorah, I'm assuming you use oil in this menorah, it gets a little bit grungy. Granted that it's grunge from a mitzvah, right? There's nothing I like more than a Haggadah that has wine stains and crumbs in it, matzah crumbs. It's a beautiful thing when something is used for a mitzvah. Nonetheless, they don't want you to use a menorah that's filled with all the old detritus from the lighting that you did in previous years. They want it to look new. And if you can't get a new one, then at least do something to the old one to make it look new. Why? Again, a concern for beauty. Right? That's what this is fundamentally about, is the beauty of it. Take a look at source number 6. Last example. The Gemara talks about how we light Hanukkah candles, and it says, Mitzvah Hanukkah ner ish ubeso. The mitzvah of Hanukkah is that you have one lamp for a person and his whole household. That's it. One each night. Right? This is probably familiar to many people. V'amahadrin, those who beautify it, will do ner l'chol echad v'yachad. They'll do one lamp for each person in the household. So each of us is going to light one lamp every single night. I used to live in Pennsylvania. It was in Pennsylvania Dutch country. And apparently the German Catholics have a practice of lighting just a light in their window every night in December. And so I used to see them do this every night. They were more from than we were, and so they celebrated Hanukkah for a long, long time. And they all had this one lamp, but they weren't mahadrin min hamahadrin. They didn't do one per night. They just had one light in each window. But the statement here is, after we get to those who beautify the mitzvah, according to Beit Shammai, those who beautify still more light 8 lamps on the first day and then reduce by 1 per day. According to Beit Hillel, which is our practice, you light 1 lamp on the first day and then you increase by 1 per day. So the Gemara tells us that there's a basic way to do the mitzvah, there is a beautiful way to do the mitzvah, and then there's a really beautiful way to do the mitzvah. Again, the emphasis on beauty. Now the truth is I cheated in my translation, because the word in the Hebrew was mehadrin. Does mahadrin have to mean beautiful? No. What else could it mean? Sort of. When we finish a masechta, right? We do a siyum. We make a celebration for having completed a big mitzvah. And we recite something called a hadran, in which we say, hadran alach, vadrach alan, which could mean, our beauty is upon you and your beauty is upon us, but it also could mean, we will return to you and you will return to us. Take a look, please, at source number 7. Tos was writing in the 13th century. It appears to Rabbeinu Yitzchak that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, who were the ones who said it's candles per night, right, the last view that you do, 8 candles on the 8th night and so on, refer only to the candle per household approach, so that this would provide greater beauty. The first part of this is not so germane for us. He's discussing which one we're referring to here, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Are you lighting per night if you have one per member of the household? And that's not the point. The point is that he uses the term providing greater beauty. That's what he really wants here. In other words, Mahadrin is an expression of Hidur meaning beauty. Rashi disagrees. And in source number 8, Rashi says, "V'amahadrin achar hamitzvos," those who pursue mitzvot. So hidur doesn't mean beauty. Hidur means something that you pursue, something that you run after. So there is another way to explain it. But I'm going to go with Tosfos for right now, because this is a shiur about hidur and about beauty. And Tosfos' position is that we light more candles because we want to beautify the mitzvah. And if you don't like Tosfos, you want to take Rashi, that's fine. Because I still have Maseches Sofrim that said, use a beautiful menorah. And I still have the Gemara saying that the Chashmonaim tried to use the most beautiful menorah possible. So if Hanukkah is really a rejection of the Greek emphasis on physical beauty, I don't understand why we are so caught up in a beautiful menorah. Why are we doing that? I thought we didn't like beauty. I thought the Greeks were the ones who were all about beauty. So I think it's important to understand, again, this Greek concept that they call kalos. And for this, we need a little bit of background in philosophy. We think of traits, of characteristics, of properties of something, as adjectives. So for example, if I were to draw a shape on here, sorry, I've got to stay with the camera. If I were to draw a shape here, like that, you would say that was a triangle. See, I'm not a good artist, but my finger, I'm really good. That would be a triangle. Okay. A triangle is a description of three lines that meet in a certain way, right? It forms three angles, right? Hence, triangle. Good. If you look at this folder, you say, what color is this? Blue. Blue is an adjective, right? If I say, you know, stipulating right now that this is solid because you can't touch it, but this is solid, you look at it and say, okay, this is a solid entity. Those are adjectives. Triangle is a description of a physical entity. Blue is a description of a physical entity. Solid is a description of a physical entity, right? That's the way we think. That's not the way the Greeks thought. Going back to Plato, who precedes Hanukkah by more than a century, but he sets up Greek philosophy, in this sense, these properties are actually examples of an entity that exists in another world that's like what we would think of as heaven. There's another world in which these properties exist as separate entities. In other words, somewhere out there is the perfect triangle. It is more of a triangle than any triangle in this universe. Somewhere out there is the perfect blue. There's a color blue somewhere that is more blue than any blue that's going to exist in this world. Somewhere out there is solid. And it is more solid than any solid that you're ever going to encounter here, and so on. All the things that we think of as adjectives actually exist as entities somewhere in another world. If anyone here reads Neal Stephenson... Oh, all right. He has a book called Anathem that focuses on this concept. But in any case, in Platonic thought, beauty is a separate entity. There is something called beauty that I can't imagine, that I can't fathom, that exists in an abstract sense off in that universe, and it is more beautiful than anything in this realm. And what's particularly fascinating to me is that the more you read about this, the more you find similarities between the way they described beauty and what we use to describe the Torah. Take a look on your sheet, the reverse side of the sheet. Source number 9. This is from a work called Phaedrus from Plato. There abides the very being, there, in that realm, abides the very being with which true knowledge is concerned, a reality which is colorless, formless, intangible, visible only to mind, the pilot of the soul. She beholds justice and temperance and gains knowledge absolute, not that which is found in varying forms in one or other of those regions of becoming which we men call real, but real knowledge really present where true being is. That was probably entirely nonsensical to anyone who hadn't read the part that it came from. But the idea is, there's another realm, separate from this one, where the neshama exists, he's not calling it a neshama, where the soul exists, before it enters this world. And in that world, you perceive that which is true. You perceive all of these forms that only have examples of them in this world. And now take a look at what he does with that in source number 10. He says, "The soul which has seen most of truth shall be placed in the seed from which a philosopher or lover of beauty and follower of the muses will spring." So in other words, the highest level soul perceived the most in that world, and that's going to become a philosopher in this world, because I'm Plato and I'm a philosopher. Those who have perceived the greatest things are going to become most sensitive to it in this world. "That which has seen truth in the second degree shall be some righteous king or warrior chief." Remember that within Plato's concept of government, you're governed by people who are smarter than everybody else and who are more sensitive and know how to run things than everybody else. The common people don't know that much. The rulers are the ones who do. "The soul which is of the third rank shall be a politician or business manager or trader. The fourth shall be a lover of gymnastic toils or a physician. The fifth shall lead the life of a prophet or a seer," and so on down the line. The greater your perception in this, so to speak, Olam HaEmes, this world of truth that he's envisioning, the greater your development in this world. But the real kicker is in source number 11. He says, When he sees any earthly beauty, he is transported, the word he belongs there, with the recollection of the true beauty. He would like to fly away, but he cannot. He is like a bird fluttering and looking upward and careless of the world below, and he is therefore thought to be mad. In other words, a person who has greatest sensitivity to beauty because of what he perceived before he ever entered this world, when he sees something beautiful here, he is grabbed by it. He is transfixed by it because it reminds him of what he saw before he entered this world. And people think he's mad the way he's gripped by this beauty that he's envisioning from that other realm. And he says, "And I have shown this of all inspirations to be the noblest and highest and the offspring of the highest, that it is recognized to be such by him who has or shares in it, and that he who loves the beautiful is called a lover because he partakes of it." In other words, he says, this is the greatest desire. He says, you might see a triangle and remember having seen a perfect triangle in that realm, but that's not going to grab you the same way. Beauty grabs. And he says, it's the highest of the forms in that realm, and that when a person enters this world, they strive for beauty, the beauty they remember from there. I brought more here in source number 11. It's an interesting read, but I'm going to skip from that right now. You can feel free to take a look at it later. The point that he makes is that beauty is an ideal and a separate entity and something that we want to perceive. Parenthetically, did you catch the similarity in terms of Torah, what I was thinking of here? The idea that a person learns Torah before ever entering this world and then is made to forget it and then learns it again here and remembers that which, and gravitates to that which he perceived beforehand. It's very interesting. But what we do with Torah is what he is trying to do with beauty. And to actually take a look at the last source, number 12, from his symposium, he puts this in the mouth of Socrates. "Only in the contemplation of beauty is human life worth living." I say he puts it in the mouth of because it's a play in which he has dialogue from different speakers, and this is the script that he gives to Socrates. "Only in the contemplation of beauty is human life worth living." So, as far as Plato is concerned, beauty is a separate entity. It is perfect. It is ideal. It is something to be pursued. It is, yeah, godlike in a sense, although he doesn't actually use that term. For the Jew, beauty is an adjective rather than a noun. We beautify something which is worthy. We don't simply say that beauty in and of itself is worthy. It's a very big difference. It's a substance. It's not. This is not semantics. This is substantive. So take it away from beauty for a minute. Think of kavod, of honor. Anybody remember what the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says about honor, about kavod? It says hakina v'hataiva v'hakavod motzien es ha'adam min ha'olam. Right? Jealousy and desire, physical desire, and kavod, honor, remove a person from this world. Right? You're not supposed to want honor. Honor is destructive. And yet, we have all sorts of mitzvos that surround giving honor to someone. Right? Can you give me examples?
Elderly.
Honoring the elderly, right? Parents, kibbut aveim. Right? Kavod tamidei chachamim, kavod atara, kavod hameis, when we take care of somebody after they've passed away. Right, we give kibudim, we call people up to be involved in mitzvos. Right. We engage in kavod all the time. Even though you told me kavod is a bad thing. Kavod is destructive. Because there's a difference between giving honor to something that is worthy and valuing honor as an entity unto itself. Honor should not be a goal of a person. Honor is not something to pursue. I would like to be in that state in which people honor me. But we absolutely do honor that which is worthy. And similarly, when you're talking about beauty, we beautify things. We beautify a mitzvah. We talked about this in the beginning. Hidur mitzvah. I will take a mitzvah, which I believe is worthy, and treat it in a beautiful way and give it beauty. I will use the nicest menorah I can use. I will use the best oil I can use. I skipped the source before, so I didn't have it on your sheet. But the Prima Gaudium says you also have to use an oil that is not fouled, an oil that will smell nice and be clear. That's also part of the requirement. We don't do it in order that people should learn to pursue beauty. We do it in order that people should learn to pursue a mitzvah. That's the idea. We want to make the mitzvah more attractive. So that going back to our initial question about how Judaism feels about beauty and why it is that here we are on the holiday when we repudiate Greek thought and yet we are playing up beauty, to the Greek, beauty is a goal with its own value, and to the Jew, beauty is a way to honor that which we value. It's not about the beauty. It's about the way that we use it. So go back to the initial sources, please. In source number one, we read about Shmuel Hanavi coming to coronate the new king, and he meets Eliab, and he's really impressed because Eliab is handsome. And Hashem rebukes him, and he says, that's not the way we do it. You may see with your eyes, but I see to the heart. It's because Shmuel has replaced the person with the beauty. He saw the beauty and said, I want to coronate the beauty. And Hashem's response is, we don't coronate the beauty, we're coronating the person. And you have to see the true person. You can't be deluded by the person's physical appearance. That's sort of part one. Now, don't get nervous. It's the bulk of what I'm going to say. But I wanted to take this idea one step further. Beyond what we've already said about beauty and the difference between Jewish and Greek concepts of beauty and what we beautify in Hanukkah, one more point. About the way that Jews celebrate their holidays. Right? The old joke, it's a tired old joke, I don't even want to repeat it except that I have to in order to get to the next point in the shiur, but that Jewish holidays, the theme is, right, they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. So there's another theme that goes within that. When we celebrate defeat of an enemy, we tend to also celebrate the defeat of the enemy's ideal. By turning the ideal on its head. Take Pesach, for example. What did we do at the original Pesach to turn the Egyptian ideal on its head? Exactly. Right? We're told to take the lamb and you tie it to the bedpost and you do it 4 days in advance of Pesach, right, before you're actually going to shecht it. Says the Medrash explaining what we're doing, it's that the Egyptians should see and we demonstrate for ourselves that we are slaughtering that which they worshipped. They worshipped the lamb, we reject that, and we actually slaughter it and use it as a feast for our God. Take Purim as another example. Haman's tool is, Yeshno Amechad Mefuzar Umeforad Bein Ha'amim. Haman's tool is, the Jew is scattered. The Jews are scattered among all the nations. V'dasem Shanos Mikolam, they're different and they don't even agree with each other, and whether he was right or not is another story. But the view of Haman is that the Jews are all diffuse and scattered, and they don't get together with each other. What do we do on Purim? Mishloach manos ish l're'ehu u'matanos le'evyonim. We make a mishta, we make a feast. We share food with each other. We send gifts of food. We give to the needy. We unify. We take that which the enemy promoted and we turn it on its head in our celebration. And I think this may be what we're doing come Hanukkah. We're taking the Greek concept of beauty and we're using it, not in their way, but as Hidur Mitzvah, to recognize the beauty of the mitzvah, of the service of Hashem. And I think that's that in and of itself is an interesting point that's worthy of exploration, how this plays out in terms of the different Yom Tovim and how a Jew celebrates, and it's a much bigger topic in its own right. But I think here that may be a reason why we place such emphasis on beauty for Hanukkah is Davka. It's specifically to take that which they promoted as their ideology and to show what a Jew does that, turning it around within our ideals. One last point. The idea of beautifying our mitzvos is more than just an abstract idea and more than just another way to make being a Jew more expensive. Right? We have enough of those. But I think there's a critical point within this. When people ask, will my child grow up to want to have a home like mine? One of the key answers is, well, what did they see in a home like yours? Did they see something that they're going to want to replicate? If children grow up in a home where going to shul is a chore, if children grow up in a home where mitzvahs are performed by rote and in a perfunctory way, this is what I need to do, so this is what I'm doing, and then I'm going to go take a nap, then they may come as adults and ask themselves, is that something I want to repeat? Is that really what I want for my own life? And the answer may well be, absolutely not. Whereas, if children see beauty of mitzvahs in the home, the physical beauty that they can recognize on their own level, that they can recognize, and that also demonstrates the way that we honor the mitzvah, it's far more likely that they're going to say, this is something attractive. This is something that I want to replicate for myself. So in addition to using beauty to honor a mitzvah, as we said in the first part, as opposed to beauty as an independent entity, and in addition to using beauty as a way to sort of take what the Greeks did and turn it on its head and show how we do it, beautifying mitzvahs on Hanukkah and on other Yom Tovim and on Shabbos and frankly even from day to day is a way to demonstrate to our kids that this is what we value, that this is what we promote, so that they will see it for themselves and, God willing, on their own, grow up wanting to be mahadrin, min hamahadrin, wanting to create this high level of beauty themselves.